Okay, we'll start. Tonight, in our continued horse race to finish the second five courses, which took like 2 years, right? We're going to cover the course about, it was called The Ethical Life, and actually it was one of the five great subjects that a monk studies in the monastery. So typically we spend 12 years on perfection of wisdom, prajnaparamita, and then we spend 4 years on madhyamika, middle way, and then 2 years on abhidhamma, 2 years on vinaya, and then every winter 3 months on logic. So these are the five subjects that you study for the Geshe program. Vinaya is what we're going to be talking about tonight and the next class, okay? So it's one of the five great subjects that Geshe study. For this institute, we've added a sixth subject called Lam Rim and Lojong, which Tibetan monks in the monasteries only get when great lamas come to teach there. So like when His Holiness comes to Sera, he'll teach Lojong or Lam Rim. There's no formal course in Lam Rim because there wasn't a tradition of Lam Rim in India per se. Lam Rim's roots are found in those five great books, but as a separate subject it wasn't taught except by visiting lamas. So, but in this institute, so we have six subjects, and then Tantra. So we're going to cover Vinaya tonight. When I met His Holiness and showed him the correspondence courses, and I said we're covering the five great subjects, he says, well, how do you do Vinaya? You know, because traditionally you don't teach Vinaya to people who don't have monk's vows. So I'm not allowed to teach you the formal vows of a monk or nun in advance of taking those vows. But what we did do in that course, which he liked, was we take Jetsun Kapa's summary of the Vinaya principles, and that we're allowed to talk about and to teach. So for this course, we took the summary of the principles of Vinaya. And this is mainly from a book by Jetsun Kapa called The Essence of the Ocean of Vinaya, meaning there are hundreds of thousands of pages written about Vinaya. Jetsun Kapa summarizes them in like 4 pages, which he was very good at. And his presentation is extraordinary. His presentation is so beautiful that every 2 weeks, the monks and nuns who go to Sojong, we start Sojong by reciting that presentation. So we recite it every 2 weeks, okay? And it starts out like a guessing game, okay? Kangla dena de la du tabe dona dure tap deshi demini mojoso satachi jabadam. Okay, that's first verse. Kangla dena de la du means, guess what it is. This is many Tibetan verses start like that, like Kangi Lodu Dibni Jinsa. There's a, you start out, you say, and the Abhidharma starts out like the Abhidharma Kosha. It's like, guess who it is who saves all beings, you know, guess who it is who. So this book starts out like, Kana Dena De La Dutava Dona Dubita. Guess what it is that, if you keep it, takes you with great ease to the city of liberation. You know, that's Jetsun Kapa's opening lines. Kana Dena De La Dutava Dona Dubita. Then he says, Deje Demi Nimbo Chok means it is the essence of the Buddha's teachings. Soso Tar Chadapadam. It is what we call Vinaya or the Pratimoksha vows. Okay? So we're going to be talking about Vinaya. I'm going to write the word Vinaya for you. Say Dulwa.
Dulwa.
Dulwa. In Sanskrit, the word is Vinaya. In Tibetan, the word is Dulwa. Dulwa comes from a root in Tibetan meaning to tame or to break a horse. Dulwa means to get a wild horse and ride him until he stops bucking and calm him down, okay? So the Tibetans chose this word to translate the Sanskrit word Vinaya, okay? People have translated Vinaya as monk's vows or monk's way of life or something like that. I don't like that translation because Kimbe Domba Dambosum, Rajin Domba Tamanga. Almost half the vows are for lay people. Okay, almost half the Pratimoksha was designed for lay people. So, out of the 8 groups of vows, 3 of them are meant for lay people, 5 are meant for people who have renounced a family way of life. Okay, so I think you should call it something like how to lead an ethical life or something like that. Okay, Vinaya. Literally, you might want to translate it as Buddhist discipline or something. Discipline giving you the feeling of, you know, the unruly student being beaten into submission with the Dharma. Okay. Dulwan. Okay, Dulwan means to tame a wild horse. Okay, what are you taming? What are you seeking to tame? You know, are you just trying to abuse your students or what? Not like that, okay? You are seeking to take the wild horse of your mental afflictions and chill them out. Okay, and that's Dulwa, that's Vinaya. Sometimes they say you're also your attraction to your senses, okay? Over attraction to food, sex, music, things like that, okay? In such a way that it distracts you from your main goals. Okay, is it bad to listen to flamenco, for example? No. Okay, is it bad to listen to it in such a way that you get distracted and don't and die before you finish your tantric studies or something? That's distracting. Okay, so dulwa, your mental afflictions, and dulwa, the attraction to your senses. Okay, like learn to put them down to a level where it doesn't disturb you, and especially when you're in retreat, put them down to a very low level. And the word in the scriptures is to use the hook of controlling your food intake and your other sense perception, your other sensual things, okay? Meaning in ancient India, when you wanted to tame an elephant, you didn't use a rope like they do with wild horses. They used an actual hook, this big meat hook, you know, like here, and you just grab them and sit them down, you know, and things like that, okay? So that's the idea, is to take your mind and to try to beat it into a sweet state of mind, okay? Now, beat is a little extreme, okay? Dulwa is a set of guidelines for people who want to control their mental afflictions, okay? Who want to stop their mental afflictions. And these are called the Pratimoksha vows. I'm going to write the word for Pratimoksha. Say, Sosor? Tarpa. Sosor? Tarpa. In Sanskrit, the word is Pratimoksha. Okay? What's the connection between Vinaya and Pratimoksha? What's the distance, this connection between Buddhist ethics and what I call freedom vows? Okay? Pratimoksha you can call freedom vows. Freedom vows are the content of the Vinaya, okay? If you want to follow the Vinaya way of life, then you have to study Pratimoksha vows, you have to study freedom vows, and you have to take the ones that are appropriate for you, the ones that you're ready to take, okay? So the way you live an ethical life in Buddhism is you take vows and then you keep them, which is a whole different thing, all right? Study, take, and then keep, all right? I don't like to call them vows. I gave a long teaching in Ireland. You know, they have such an idea in their mind when you say the word vow. You see, they're thinking of these old Irish nunneries or monasteries and grumpy and repressed are the two words that come to mind, you know, and constantly having scandals there because they're grumpy and repressed, you know. And I didn't even want to use the word vow. It's more like there are 84,000 mental afflictions. There are 84,000 wrong ways of expressing yourself that hurt you, okay? Out of those, Lord Buddha took 10 and said, these are the most common. These are the ones that are your biggest enemy, okay? And that's the basis of Pratimoksha. What he's trying to say is, if you concentrate on these 10, you've kind of covered the 84,000. I'm doing you a favor. Like, you don't have to go through a list of 84,000 vows and try to avoid every one of them. You know, I'm giving you a list of 10 that if you get good at these 10, then things will start to change. What's the point of taking a vow? It's that Lord Buddha, this being who sees, you got to get used to the idea of an omniscient being. This guy sees every thought you will ever have for the next million years. This guy sees what will happen to you every second of the next million years. This guy knows today, out of a billion possibilities of things to say to you, what's the perfect thing to say to you today? You know what I mean? That's the power of an enlightened being. So they're trying to save you time. They're trying to give you a list. They say, concentrate on this list. Everything will work out fine. Trust me. You know, I see 999,000 years from now, you're going to need this. Okay? And they just know. So what you're really getting in my mind is a list of the most powerful things you can do. You know, it's a very, very convenient. It's like somebody saving you 50 years of searching around for what to do. I don't like to call them vows. It's somebody giving you a super list or something. Super karma list? Something like that. It's 10 things, you concentrate on these, everything will be extraordinary. What's the point of taking these vows? What's the point of studying Vinaya? You go to the city of liberation. You know, but they say that about every Buddhist teaching. Come on. You know what I mean? I mean, for me, it's not... When you read a lot of scripture, you get kind of bored after a while because everything is the door to liberation. Everything is the most important teaching, you know? And after a while, you're just like, oh, yeah, yeah. You know, you're lucky it's not in English yet, or you would just be, you know, yeah, yeah. Oh, most important teaching ever, yeah, yeah. You know, So I don't think you can just stop there and say, oh, you get liberated if you practice Patimoksha. I think you have to describe the process, okay? The point is this. You come into this desire realm. We talked about it last time. This is a broken realm. This realm doesn't work right. Doesn't matter what you do in this realm, in normal daily activity, you will suffer, it'll go wrong, relationships will break up, your body will slowly destroy itself from the inside if it doesn't get hit by a car or get cancer. You know what I mean? This is what you have to look forward to. Nothing works right here. And people in millions of people in New York City are struggling to adjust it. If I just could get to Gold's Gym another day a week, then I'd be happy. You know, I like the way you talk to me, but you got that wart on your left ear, you know. If I could just find a girl that didn't have one, you know, or you're thinking adjustments, you know, if I could just adjust this or this or this, it's hopeless. Forget it. The desire realm doesn't work. Okay? This realm doesn't work. You got here by having mental afflictions in your mind and having done bad deeds in the past. Okay? That's why you're here. It's like a jail sentence. Okay? You're in a broken realm and it won't work. And it doesn't matter what kind of adjustments you make. You think all the people in the New York Times obituary this morning didn't try to make adjustments? You know, and they died. It doesn't work. Okay? And they lost everything. So, what's the point of Pratyamoksha then? It's to remove the cause of it's to remove the reason why things don't work. Okay? You gotta get used to that. It's to remove the reason why things don't work. You can remove the reason why things don't work, and then things will work right. Okay? You can't adjust them from the outside, you gotta adjust them from the inside. It doesn't matter if you go to a different gym, it doesn't matter if you take different vitamins, it doesn't matter if you join a yoga club or not. You know, those things don't, it doesn't matter if you get a better job or a different wife or a different apartment. It doesn't matter. Those adjustments don't change anything. And it doesn't change anything to go to ACI classes and graduate from 17 courses and turn in all your homeworks and blah, blah, blah. If you don't do something inside. And the whole point of Pratimoksha is, these are things that you do inside. Okay? So, Pratimoksha vows are a way to adjust from the inside your behavior. So you have to learn them. The most powerful karmas you can do. You got a free list from Lord Buddha, okay? And then you have to study them so that you understand what the vow is. I mean, most American Buddhists have no idea what their vows are, and then a few of them have wrong ideas about what their vows are, okay? But you have to go and study what your vows are. You have to understand them clearly. You have to understand the nyeme. What's a nyeme? Nyeme means like exceptions to the vow. You know, yeah, the vow is that, but you're supposed to do this in these circumstances. You know what I mean? Like, most people don't even know the basic vow. On top of that, you have to know what the exceptions are, and you have to know how to prioritize your vow. If a tantric vow bumps into a pratimoksha vow, what am I supposed to do? Okay? What am I supposed to do if the tantric vow says A, and the pratimoksha says B, and I have to do them both at the same time? What am I supposed to do? Things like that. What to do when a priority crisis occurs. Okay? And you have to know, you basically think about yourselves as becoming master vow keepers. Okay? Like, some people think of themselves as a good tennis player, or some people think of themselves as a good piano player, or a good stockbroker, or something like that. But everybody in this room should have in the back of their mind that in the next couple of years, I would like to become a master vow keeper. Okay? Like, you never heard the word, right? Because I just made it up. But, okay. No, but think of it as your occupation. You say, what do you do for a living? I keep my vows. I'm a vow keeper. Yeah. Okay? Really? Somebody, there's a scripture we were studying the other day. Somebody walked down the street and said, hey, vow keeper, you should turn around. Okay? You know? And you say, oh, yeah, that's me. And you think of yourself that way. Okay? Like you know your vows well. Very well. You know how they work. You know why they're important. You know the exceptions. You know the traps. You know the dangers of, you know, of certain vows. You know them frontwards and backwards. And you keep them in your book. Okay? There's nothing like that. We had a meeting today, which is why I'm late and I'm sorry, about the Arizona place. It's going really well. Winston and Rob went out on horses for 3 days to ride the whole place because we've never seen 80% of it. And we thought there might be a Martian landing site or a toxic waste dump, and we wanted to check, you know. But I think they'll sign the contract in a week or something. And but I said at the beginning of the meeting, they said, you want to say anything? Because it's a wonderful project because I don't do anything. And I said, yeah. I don't want anybody on this board who doesn't keep a book. You know what I mean? Because once you keep a book, your whole life changes. You know, once you're a vow keeper, your whole life changes. Then Buddhism becomes something that helps you and works on you. And if you don't, then I don't even want to be close to you because you'll screw up at some point. You know what I mean? It's dangerous to be close to a person who's not keeping their vows or doesn't know their vows. You know, it's like being near a drunk guy with a knife. You know, like you just don't want to be around him too close. You know, I'm nice to know you and I love you and, you know, come for dinner once in a while, but, you know, they're waving this knife around, you see? And you want to be around people who are keeping their vows. And you want to keep your vows. You've got to keep your book, okay? It's useless to study these vows tonight if you're not keeping your book. And they'll have no effect on you, okay? There's nothing about studying the vows that's particularly going to be a huge good karma immediately. But if you keep keeping them and knowing them from hour to hour, you go through a process whereby, and I'm not exaggerating, your reality changes about once a year. Okay? You move up in the evolutionary chain of spiritual stuff. Like you made it to human already. I'm not talking beyond that. Okay? Like within the human realm, there's different levels of happiness and different levels of spiritual, totally different perceptions of your reality. And if you keep these vows, you start moving up through this invisible food chain of spiritual realizations. Like, keeping these vows, understanding them, you will already start to see a different reality around you. And it's incredible. And people who don't keep their vows, not only is it impossible for them to see that reality, you can't talk to them about it. Like, you can sit there and say, look, I swear to God, keep this pratimoksha stuff for a year. You wouldn't believe what's going to happen to you. And they'll say, what's for dinner? You know? And see, they don't have kalwa. We call kalwa means the good karma to even hear about it. They don't get it. They don't only not get it, they don't even hear it. You know, you say, no, I was talking about these vows. Look, pratimoksha, sasatapa, freedom, you know? And they're like, but what's for dessert? You know? And what I'm saying is that you will go through different levels. If you start keeping these vows, things around you start to change because you are on your way to liberation. It doesn't happen in a day. And every one of about 10 different levels on the way there, your whole reality around you changes. People change, food change, sounds change, events change. Extraordinary things start to happen to you. You will never know. You will be one of those people that got left behind in the level number one if you don't keep these vows. If you don't try it, you'll never know. And you'll never even get it. When someone's describing it in front of a group of people, you'll be like, yeah, it's hot in here. I wonder when time he's going to shut up, you know? And you know what I mean? And these are invisible worlds that coexist in this room. Some people are on different levels of them. And you'll never know if you don't keep your vows. You just will never know. So keep them. I mean, that's what really happens. You know, your reality starts to go through amazing transformations about once a year. And getting more and more extraordinary, you know. But nothing happens if you don't know these vows and you don't keep them, okay? By the way, to get to Bodhisattva and Tantric vows, you must have these, you mean, some form of these vows, okay? At least keeping the 10 virtues. Better if you can take lifetime layman's vows, okay? And then even nicer if you can take monk's vows and nun's vows. Do you have to have monk's vows and nun's vows to see emptiness directly? Not at all, okay? Do you have to have monk's vows and nun's vows to practice Tantra? No. Is it an excellent place to be in to see emptiness and to practice Tantra? Yes. Okay? So, I mean, it's a great thing, but I don't see it necessarily in the United States that it's going to have to be like that. You can, if you take layman's vows and keep them sweetly and understand them, and then on top of that take Bodhisattva vows and Tantric vows, you can very, very easily reach enlightenment in this lifetime, no problem. You don't have to think. I'm not trying to sell you monks and nuns vows. For those of you who are attracted to it, it's incredible. And it's a great place to be in to get enlightened. But you don't have, but you should take some kind of pratimoksha commitment, even if it's not monks and nuns vows, like lifetime layman's vows. Come on. No killing a human. No stealing a lot of money. No stealing another person's wife. No lying about seeing emptiness, and no drinking alcohol. Come on. Is this hard? I mean, you can't do that for your whole life? And then people tell me, oh, I do that anyway. I mean, I don't do that anyway. Okay? and no, big difference. Taking a vow and just being that way, totally different thing. Okay? If you're attracted to not doing these five things, it's because your last lifetime worked his or her butt off big time. And that's why you have this attraction. If you don't take care of that attraction, and if you don't get it stronger and deeper by taking vows, then you'll lose it. You see, that attraction to Buddhism or that attraction to an ethical life already, you don't like to kill, you don't like to lie, you don't like to steal, that didn't come from nowhere. You worked on it for thousands of years, and that got you here. Now you have to take care of that. That instinct is not an instinct. It was hard work, and that's why you got it, and other people don't have it, maybe, okay? And then you have to take care of it, and then you have to develop it by taking vows, okay? The karma of, for example, not killing humans because you don't like to, or you didn't have a chance yet, okay? Or taking a vow not to kill a human and consciously watching it every day and keeping it in a very subtle way, you know, like not even letting a pencil be on the floor because somebody might slip on it. The karma of that is extraordinary. And then you go through these reality shifts every year or so. Okay, unbelievable. Things start. All the stuff you ever read about in those Bible stories in Sunday school are true. All those miracles and amazing things happening to people, totally true. They happen to people who keep their vows. Okay? So what's that got to do with sosatara? Sosara means individual. Tapa means freedom. And all the books say the same thing. Why do they call them prati moksha? Prati, by the way, means individual. Moksha means freedom in Sanskrit. The Tibetan is sosotarpa. Individual freedom means people who keep the vows get the freedom. People who don't keep the vows, guess what? They don't get the freedom. It's an individual matter. So they call the vows what? Prati moksha vows, individual freedom vows. Okay? Those who keep them go to freedom. Those who don't. Okay? I tell you one trick about pratimoksha vows. You have to take them because you're sick of this broken realm. That has to be in your mind when you take them. Okay? When you take them, something grows in your body. Some invisible, beautiful energy grows in your body and stays there until the day you die. Okay? When you take a pratimoksha vow. But if you don't have the right motivation, they never form. You can sit through a ceremony, 4-hour ceremony, and hear everything, and you can answer Lexar and Cholak, you know, at the right places, which is really hard to do, okay? And then you won't get the vows if you don't, if it doesn't occur in your mind. By the way, it only has to occur for like 30 seconds, okay? I mean, it's discussed in the scripture. You don't have to have this beautiful motivation from the beginning to the end. Like, you can be thinking, those robes are pretty cool, I'd like to have those. That's okay for about 5 minutes. But somewhere during the ceremony, you have to think, I'm fed up with this broken realm, and I want out of here. You know, I want to move to a higher level of spiritual evolution. You know, I believe what that guy said in that class, and I'm waiting for it to happen. And I understand I have to take vows for that to happen. Okay? That has to occur in your mind when you take a vow, or it doesn't form in your being. There's a thing called, what's it called? Kechewe Gelong. Gelong Kechewa means a fully ordained monk who agreed to take the vows and went through the whole ceremony and goes through their whole life wearing robes and does not have vows. Okay? Because during the ceremony it didn't occur to them once that I'm taking this so I can get out of this realm. Okay, this realm of suffering, you know, this realm that doesn't work. Okay, so when you take your vows, even if it's just the five layman's vows, you have to have this. You have to be thinking of it when you take the vows. Okay, this realm doesn't work. The only thing I have to look forward to is getting old, wrinkly, deaf, blind, stupid. What do you call it? When they lose their memory. See now. Yeah. Okay, like that's all you have to look forward to. You know, we're discussing today a retirement community out in Arizona, which is a big effort for a 45-year-old. And then somebody says, "Yeah, but you're going to have a care facility for the people who move out of the retirement community." And I'm like, "Oh, come on, I didn't really have to think about that." You know, yeah, you move up through those levels. You know, apartment in Manhattan, house in New Jersey, nursing home in Florida, and then a care facility in Florida, and then, you know the rest. Okay. So that has to be in your mind when you take vows, all right? That's what we're going to be studying. Okay, that's Vinaya. That's what we're doing. Okay. People think Vinaya is some kind of old-fashioned thing. People think it's arcane. People think it has no relevance in the modern world. People think it can never work in the United States. You know, the monks and nuns vows and things like that. That's just because they don't understand the vows. If you understood the vows and you understood how they work, then you just automatically start wanting to keep them and to take them, okay? That's all. And they're beautiful, okay? I'm going to go through what Jetsun Kapa promises to cover in his little book, okay? There are 6 categories to study Vinaya, okay? And he says, which means, first he describes what is a pratimoksha vow. Okay? What is it? What do they do? Okay? And then he answers it in his text. He says, Shenu shidan chepale dopa means the day you decide as a spiritual practice, in order to get out of this broken realm, that you will never again hurt another living creature, then you are fulfilling the essence of Vinaya, in the essence of Pratimoksha. So the essence of Pratimoksha, law, means to decide, I will never hurt another living being. That's the essence of this kind of vow. Now, Bodhisattva vows are different. They are more like, I will work my butt off to get enlightened so I can help other people. Tantric vows, I will work my butt off in this life and finish it and get to Buddhahood so I can help other people. But Pratimoksha vows, the essence or the emphasis is, in order to advance myself spiritually, I swear I will not hurt another living thing. Okay? Period. In any of the forms, Shenu Shidan Dopa. Shenu means hurting other beings, which is reflected in the 10 non-virtues by how many? 7. Okay? 3 physical, 4 verbal. How do you hurt other people? Kill, steal, sexual misconduct. How do you hurt people verbally? Lying, slander, harsh talk, idle gossip, idle talk. Okay? So does Pratimoksha only cover those 7? Jetsun Kampa says, no, Shidan Chepan Ne. Shidan Chepan means, oh, and by the way, you also have to give up the 3 things that motivate those 7, okay? Which is the last 3 of the 10, which is, they call craving, ill will, wrong view, okay? But I like, for me, craving boils down to being unhappy when other people get something they like.
Yeah.
I don't like it when someone else gets something they like. How many times have you thought that today? Maybe once or twice. No, Lord Buddha would say, I chose it out of 84,000 mental fiction. You must be having it every 5 minutes or so. Some slight version of a little bit unhappy that someone else looks good in their dress today, or someone else's Tibetan is better than yours, or, you know, someone else gets to talk to them and you don't, or some version of that has crossed your mind several times in the last 5 minutes. That's number 8. Unhappy that other people are getting something nice, which is so un-bodhisattva, okay? Number 9, the opposite, which is what? Be happy when they screw up. Oh, she's wearing that really ugly dress today. You know, okay? Or some version of that, you know what I mean? There's this sick state of mind that we all have, or we wouldn't be in this realm. Okay, you gotta get used to that. If you are in this realm and you're not a tantric deity, or some kind of emanation or like that, or someone in disguise basically, then you do have these thoughts constantly. You know, like little pleasures taken out of other people's problems. Okay? And it's just part of our brain that got us to this realm. Okay? And then wrong views, which are, I mean, the biggest one is, what causes this world? You know? How do you get around in this world? What's the way to get what you want in this world? Okay? Only good karma. Nothing else matters. And nothing else works. It doesn't matter how smart you are. It doesn't matter if you do the right thing at the right time in the right place. It has nothing to do with anything. It's, have you helped other beings in the last half hour? Because that's the only way to get anything. That's the only reason anything ever happens that's good in this world. Okay? And not to understand that is the motivation for the first 7. Okay, so they say Shinna Shiva Chipley. So someone comes up to you and says, what's Pratimoksha about? You say, avoiding any kind of harm to other living beings. And avoiding the kind of thinking that makes you do that harm. You see what I mean? By saying avoiding harm to other living beings, you're saying the first 7. By saying avoiding the kind of mindset that makes you want to hurt other people, the last 3. Okay, get used to it. Alright? Shinna Shiva Chipley. So that's the ngo. Ngo Dani Rabye. Rabye means category number 2. Okay, if you're going to study the Naya, category number 2. This is easy. Hey, look, there's just 8 different kinds of Pratimoksha vows. What are they? Well, there's a one-day vow. Okay? What's a one-day vow mean? You know, people took a Mahayana one-day vow. That's totally different from this vow. Okay? This is a Hinayana one-day vow. This is like a different vow. We don't take them nowadays. I mean, they don't have this custom nowadays. Sometimes we take a one-day vow. That's a totally different thing. That's a Mahayana one-day vow. Okay? And people aren't doing this much. But it's basically for the length of 1 day to avoid 8 really bad things. Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. You know, special things for the length of a day. Okay? 1 day Pratimoksha vow. Which is not even, I'm not aware that anyone takes them anymore in the Tibetan tradition. We take the Mahayana version. Okay? Genyen Pamada. Genyen Pama means, what should we say? A person who agrees to keep a lifetime vow, layman's vow. Okay? So you've got a 1 day vow, and then you've got a layman's vow. Lifetime layman's vow. How many parts? 5. Okay? Nachi Naga. Hey, wait a minute, the text says you can take 1 or 2 or 3. Hey, technically speaking, maybe it happened in the past, okay? But the commentators say, no, you should take them all, okay? You really should take them all. Somebody says, oh, but the Lama said I didn't have to take alcohol one. Muchadama Bhatta says, Forget that. You don't even, it's not even a question for people with lifetime layman's vows. Why? No Buddhist can drink alcohol. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? The Lama said you didn't have to take that one. You can't drink alcohol anyway. Okay? Lord Buddha said, Bhakalam Rinpoche asked me to say it on Mongolian TV. I think he was setting me up. Lord Buddha said, whosoever drinks the amount of alcohol or serves to another that you could put on the tip of a blade of grass, don't call yourself a Buddhist, okay? I don't know you. Okay? Quote. And unfortunately, the commentaries say also applies to chemical drugs and other stuff, okay? Does it apply to coffee and tea? No. Okay, can you take NyQuil or cough syrup? Yes, if you're not doing it to get drunk, okay? Alright, no, just to clarify, okay? But anyway, so five vows. They split that into male and female. So how many we got so far?
Three.
Okay, those are the layman's vows. Those are vows that lay people can take, okay? Now we get into the ordained vows, okay? Getul Pama means four and five are what you could call novice monk and novice nun. Okay. They keep 36, if you split them out, it's 36 different vows. Okay, Langde Sodu. For the rest of their life. Okay. And then you have a special category for women called an intermediate nun's vow. Intermediate nun's vow. Gelobma. Okay. And then you have Gelom Ma, Gelom Pa, meaning fully ordained monk, fully ordained nun. Okay, how many we got? Eight total. Okay, three for lay people, five for, because we're splitting out male and female. Okay, so I'll go backwards. Fully ordained monk, fully ordained nun, intermediate nun, novice monk, novice nun, and then onto the lay people's vows. Lifetime man's layman's vow, lifetime woman's layman's vow, and then the one day pratimoksha vow. And that's the eight different kinds. Okay? You're getting the short version of Jetson Kapa's. Is there a question?
Yeah, I think there was an eight vow, like what they call.
Okay. There are two other levels. There's a level called a Rabchung. Rabchung means person who has left the home life. Okay? This is not considered one of the Pratimoksha commitments. It's called it's not a vow, it's a commitment. So when you say, how many vows are there? You say eight. Well, what about that commitment to leave the home life? You say, that's called technically a commitment, and it's not considered one of the eight vows. Okay? So there's eight vows and a commitment, and an extra thing called a commit. It's a commitment. Okay? That's where basically you make a decision to leave the home life, to leave the family life, but you haven't yet decided whether to take, you have not taken formally vows yet. So you can be a Rabchung and not yet be a novice. Okay? And that's those kids running around the monastery with robes on. Because you have to be at an age where you can understand what's going on before you take, for example, full ordination cannot be taken before the age of 20. Nishin Malan Deshidan. Okay? So you have to be, I like that system. Okay? It means that you may see kids running around Tibetan monasteries, they're what we call Rabchungs. They don't have formal vows yet. Okay? And then when you reach the age of 20, you're eligible to make the decision to become a full monk or nun. And I like that system. Don't forget that when this thing started, that you'd be about halfway through your life. You see what I mean? By that point. So really, I think nowadays, I took vows at almost 30, and I had 15 years of adult life to try everything. And I think it might be better, because a lot of times when you take a kid at 7 years old and keep him in the monastery until 20, and then make him a fully ordained monk, he hasn't had a chance to see all those things. He still thinks they'd be fun to try. And, I don't know about, I think it might be good to take them later. You know, personally, I kept them for 8 years before I took them. And I think that's maybe a good rule of thumb or something like that. I think it may be a good idea to do it that way, but we'll talk about that later. Okay. Anyway, that's the difference. And there's another commitment one, I don't remember what it is. Anybody remember? Rupchung and something else. Oh, No, I don't remember. I don't think so. Anyway, there is a version of the lifetime layman's vows where you can take a celibacy vow on top of the five, but that's a Sangha Ganyan. But there's another one, I don't remember. Anyway, Rabi Den, Sosong Wunzen, Gary Den. Sosong Wunzen means where they go through the different eight sets of vows and describe roughly what they are. Okay? So that's where you go through and you identify what the vows are. So now we have three categories in the study of Vinaya. What is Vinaya? You know. What is Patimoksha? You know. Not hurting other beings and not thinking in a way that would cause you to hurt them. Then you have the divisions, which are eight. And then you have the identification of what's included in each of the eight, roughly. Okay? Rabbi Den, Kewe Ten means, this is category number four in the study of Vinaya. Okay? And by the way, it doesn't matter if you study Vinaya for 100 years or for half an hour. You still would go through these same categories, just in more detail. The really great commentaries are 1,000 pages long, and they're beautiful. Okay? They're really, really beautiful. Okay? Kewe Ten means who can take vows and who cannot. Okay? Who can take vows and who cannot. And this basically, in the commentary, he's describing, you know, you obviously have to be of a certain age if you take fully ordained monk's vows and things like that. But more basically, Jetsun Kapa discusses basic personality traits that, or basic things about your being that have to be there for you to take a vow. Okay? He's talking about sexual energy. Okay? We say that to take a pratimoksha vow and to keep it, you must have a human body, A. B, that human body must be of a nature that has a certain kind of sexual energy. You have to have a male energy or a female energy. There are other beings who are born as humans who are like neuters or like have lost their sexual identity physically through, you know, like getting shot in a war or something like that. But they don't have, they say that the essence of manhood or womanhood, there's an energy in your mind and your body described in the second chapter of the Abhidharma Kosha, for example, that gives you a sense of resolve. Okay? It allows you to make firm decisions. Okay? And people who lose that through physical accidents or who maybe never had it when they were born are wishy-washy. Okay? They can't keep a commitment. They don't have a firm state of mind or a resolved state of mind to where they can take a vow and keep the vow. Okay? And that's the basic thing. Now there's a psychological side to who can take the vows, which is on other continents or in other realms, people don't have enough suffering to think that they should get out of this place. Okay? The desire realm is perfect because it's got this perfect mix of ecstasy. I mean, you surf a good wave, see a certain kind of moon or a sunset, see a certain kind of flower, meet a certain kind of child, see the beauty of this realm, and then see the horror of this realm. You know, see somebody burned in a car accident. I talked to a policeman today, and he's describing, you know, the first time somebody died in his arms while he was, you know, our realm goes from that to that. And so you can get inspired by the beauty, and then you can look at the ugliness and say, I want to remove that. And that's the kind of people who can take vows. Okay, you have to have this kind of thing. You have to have ability to be resolved. You have to have ability to keep a vow. Take it and keep it, and kick butt. You know, I'm keeping this vow. I don't care what anybody says. Okay? Like that. Some kind of energy. It's connected to your sexual identity also. Okay? So, means how do you lose these vows? Okay? What makes you lose a pratimoksha vow? Okay? Domba tongwe gilani lapa puda shi puda teni chuna nansengyo. Domba tongwe gilani. There are two ways to lose vows. We call them the normal ways and the special ways. Okay? Alright? We're talking pratimoksha vows, right? tantric vows, bodhisattva vows, you know how you lose them. I mean, you have to really mess up big time, because otherwise you keep them even after you die. Okay? But pratimoksha vows, you lose on the moment you die. Okay? Jisi tsoi pardu in the Vinaya, until the day I die. Okay? Like that. So there's normal ways to lose your vows and special ways to lose your vows. What are the normal ways to lose your vows? Lavapu means you give them back formally in a ceremony. You know, you go to the abbot and you say, I want to give them back formally, and you give them back. Okay? Lavapu. Shipu means you die. Okay? And then there's some other ones about if you change sexes more than 3 times or something like that. Okay, I'm not going to go into them. All right? But apparently even in ancient India, there were cases where people just spontaneously became a man who had been a woman. And then you become a fully ordained monk if you've been a fully ordained nun. But then if you switch back again, you still become the opposite again. But if you keep doing that after sitting in front of that, I guess the energy of the vow can't hold it anymore or something. I don't know. Okay, teni chundam lansangyo. Teni chung means if you get both sexual organs, or lansangyo means if they change more than a certain amount of time, then you lose the vow. Those are the normal ways to lose vow. Okay, now we get to the abnormal ways. Okay. No, now they're the special ways to lose vow. Okay, special ways. Special meaning specific to certain vows. Okay, like how do you lose a one-day vow? When you can see the lines on your hands from the natural light of the sky the next morning, you have lost the vow. Okay? And I told you this story of friends who took a fasting vow for one day. They're sitting there the next morning with a box of cookies, holding their hand out the window, you know, waiting for the light, you know, and then you can eat the cookies, you see. Okay. And then there are special nishimalan means. Now, there's special weird cases. You don't have to know about them. Okay. Like, if you thought you were 20, but you weren't 20, and you fight, as long as you thought you were 20, even if you're still 19, you still have the vow. But if your mother says, hey, I lied to you, you know, you were born 2 years early before I met your father or something, and then you lose the vow the moment you know. Okay, and there's stuff like that, okay, but you don't have to know. Okay, doing good on pay your day. Category number 8 is, am I on number 8? 6, sorry. Category number 6, which is the last one. Is that senility thing? Okay. It is senility, right? The benefits of keeping them. And I already went through it with you, okay? If you're going to bore people, say, hey, you can get to nirvana. You know, I prefer to take them through the process. Come on. Every 6 months, every year, if you keep them assiduously, if you really keep a book from hour to hour, you will definitely see changes in your reality. I'm talking your whole reality. Food tastes better, music sounds better, you feel lighter, stronger, healthier. Amazing, you know, you start to meet amazing people. You get to a point where all the people around you are these amazing, creative, beautiful people. And it's not like you bought them, or you put an ad in the New York Times or something like that. Your karma has driven them to you. And your whole life becomes like a dream. And it gets better and better and sweeter the older you get. As opposed to the normal way of life goes. You see what I mean? So if you keep them, it just gets better every day. Things just get better every day. And once you see that process start to happen, you will want to keep them. You see? So this idea of grumpy and repressed, you don't have to worry about that. That's not what Buddhist vows are about. You start keeping them for 6 months to a year, carefully, watching your book, it's the happiest way to be. You know? You're just getting everything you ever dreamed of, and you know it, and you know where it's coming from, and you're like turned on, and you're like, oh, give me some more vows, you know? Okay? It's like that. When they become a te, when they become an obligation, when it feels repressive or grumpy or something like that, then you're not keeping vows. You don't know what vows are. Something got messed up there. Okay? There should be, you keep them, you realize the effect they have on your mind, and then you watch the effect on your reality. And then you're like, give me more. You know, hey, where are those bodhisattva vows? Where's the tantric vows? You know, one more of this stuff, you know, and it works. Okay, so that's my advertisement for Pratimoksha vows. At least take a lifetime layman's vow. Big difference between keeping them and just keeping them naturally because you're that kind of person. Okay, and then as you can, move up to the other vows. We will have a ceremony. I don't know what it is. It's in your schedule. But we will have a Bodhisattva vow ceremony, first half, soon. I think in early August. Then we'll have a second half, which is a Bodhisattva vow ceremony towards the end of the fall. And somewhere in there we'll squish a lifetime layman's vow ceremony. Okay? Or we'll say there's no time, but we'll find a time. And then take them if you can. Okay? And very powerful. They change you a lot. Okay? Question? Yeah. You have to have refuge vows before you take Pratimoksha vows. And it's a very beautiful 12 commitments. Not hard. I like to do it as a separate class. So I won't give a person refuge vows, and I refuse to give a person lifetime layman's vows unless I bored them for about 2 hours with the details. Because I want you to know what you're taking. You should never take a vow without knowing what it is. Because you won't be able to keep it if you don't know what it is, okay? It's crazy. People go around giving people a vow. I think it's very irresponsible, actually. Okay? You got to know what they are, or you're going to break them. Okay? So anyway, we'll be having opportunities to take all those vows. And you know, you're required to study them before. I'll make you come to a class where you learn them beforehand. If you want to take Bodhisattva vows in the fall, you must start that course now. Okay? You must finish that course on the Bodhisattva vows. There's a lot of vows there, 64 vows plus a lot of other stuff that they never told you about. And that's a whole course. And you can do it at home study, but I guess it'll take you a month or month and a half at least. So you should start now. Because I refuse to give them to people who haven't finished that course, and I won't, okay? You can take the wish in August, early August, without taking that course, which is a commitment to think like a bodhisattva. But if you want to take the commitment to act like a bodhisattva, which will happen in November or something, I think, you have to finish that course. You should start during the break. I think around August 15th we'll be off, so you can start taking them, okay? All right, we'll take a break there. I'm sorry, David Sykes? Venerable? Sorry.
My feeble mind needs some clarification.
Okay.
Majjhimaka Prasanayoga clearly propounds that all phenomena lack inherent existence, you know, that they're all empty. The only thing that is the fact that they lack inherent existence.
Okay.
The presentation of Pratimoksha vows says that, there is this, there is this, you know, a cause will then bring about an effect. There is seem to be a fluid effect coming from these causes. That's what a vow, the purpose of taking a vow.
Yeah.
Now in that presentation, they then go back over the other side of the lack of inherence and say, now there are these special cases.
Who said that?
Special cases. Well, these special cases in which the vows, you know, the special nyemes in which
don't
collect that money.
Yeah, yeah.
Now clearly...
No, not only you don't collect... Okay.
...doesn't seem to come up. Either it should be one way or the other. But the reason why I'm arguing this is because then, of course, vow keepers, there must be nyemes to vow keepers. Maybe they're a nyeme to a person who say doesn't keep a book, that's still keeping a
vow. It's impossible.
Sound,
yeah.
You're making it sound like you cannot reach, are you saying that you
okay, David's reach? Basically saying this. If things are not self-existent, that means that things don't have any nature of their own. So, for example, a person who's not keeping a book could get the benefits of keeping a vow if reality were different. You see what I mean? And since reality is not fixed, well, reality could be screwed up in such a way that people who don't keep their books might get the benefits of keeping their vows. Okay? And that's not a crazy argument, okay? There have been those arguments. Meaning, I think it boils down to this. What makes a good karma a good karma? Is it just because Lord Buddha said so? Or couldn't you ever have a case where doing a good karma would lead to a bad result? Or is that self-existent, that a good karma leads to a good result? You see what I mean? Is that in the nature of things? And I say, yes. And he said, but you just said there's no nature of things. You see what I mean? So how can you say that this always leads to this result or something like that? Okay? Is that your question?
But
no.
Yeah, but then the Niamey thing would not work. Clearly you're going to be accruing the same kind of karma,
okay,
even if you're crazy and on drugs, if you weren't crazy and on drugs, because you're still holding to that, yes, karma does seem to have some type of self-existent nature. Clearly one cause will create one effect.
Okay, that's two different questions then.
Okay. Right.
Two different questions. Is karma self-existent? Cause and effect self-existent, you know? Is killing always a bad thing and always leads to a bad result? And then the second question, if a vow was self-existently bad, then how could there be any exceptions to it? Under certain situations. You see what I mean? Like, for example, if you go crazy, if a monk goes crazy and breaks a vow, they do not break their vow. You see what I mean? If you are legally... Is that all right? Is that what you want?
No. If every phenomenon lacks inherent existence,
yeah,
then that means that I am currently living in my own reality. Now, my reality really ultimately is the alcohol and the guns that I just did, the wrong non-virtue, clearly are not that which is creating the non-virtue. You understand what I'm saying?
Wait, no.
Like the medicine is not what's getting me better. Clearly, that I can't use a karmic cop-out that I'm in a wacky state of mind.
Oh, okay. Let me try again. I have to state the question for the microphone, by the way. I get it right. If you take a risk on an investment and you get rich, did the risk cause the richness? Buddhism says no way. And by the way, that's why people who are conservative also get rich sometimes. Let me get there. So if things are not what they appear to be, and that's why the world suffers. Okay? It looks like if you lie, you can get a green card. Okay? People come to me all the time. You know? And I said, no, the lie doesn't cause the green card. You've got to understand that. If you lie and get a green card, it's because you've helped someone find a home in the past. If you lie and don't get a green card, it's because you didn't help someone get a home in the past. But either way, the lie is going to give you trouble later. You've got to get that. Lies don't create green cards. No such thing. Okay? Why? Because it doesn't always work. Duh. Okay? Hang on. I'm getting there. So I think what he's saying is then, how could alcohol or guns self-existently cause something bad, you know? Like, how is it that you would take alcohol, and how could alcohol be inherently bad then and always lead to bad results or something like that? Because it's not the alcohol. Like, if you drink alcohol and you get drunk, did the alcohol make you drunk? He says your karma made you drunk. Is there anybody who can drink alcohol and not get drunk?
Yeah.
Or people who can hold their liquor? Okay, so there is some karma there, you know, like whether you go crazy or get drunk or not, doesn't seem to depend on the alcohol, it depends on something that happened before the alcohol. But,
no, not.
Because that is the cause of them, the keeping their vows is the cause, you see what I mean? It is the correct worldview cause of getting liberated, that's all. Yeah. Huh? You can't live your vows without checking them. Impossible. That's all. If you, memorize them is going to keep them? Devadatta memorized more scripture than any monk in ancient India. What happened to him? Where is he now? He's in the hell realm, lowest hell realm. Okay? No. It's like reciting Tundra without thinking about it. Twice a day. Okay. Anyway. See you later. Okay, not much to say. Just since we're on the subject of Vinaya, I've given a lot of thought to Vinaya and what will happen in the United States about Vinaya. I think since we're talking every night about the future of Buddhism in America, then, you know, I think a lot about what will happen with Vinaya, what will happen with monks and nuns in the United States, and it's still, I think, not clear. You know, Buddhism has been here about 25 years in the United States. I think a lot. There have been maybe, I would guess, 100 Americans or 200, maybe a little more, maybe 300 have attempted to take monks or nuns vows. I'd say off the top of my head that most have given them back, okay? More than half, maybe. Something like that. I can't think of more than 10 successful monks, for example, who have kept it for more than 10 years, which is normally considered, you're considered stable after 10 years. You see what I mean? So, I think it's a question of what's going on and will Vinaya make it in the United States, okay? And I think it will. I think several things have to happen. I don't think it will make it if it goes the way it's been going, because you can see it's not making it. You see what I mean? So what's making the difference, and what would make the difference? I think, first of all, a lot of the Americans who have been ordained haven't gotten an explanation of their vows. So they don't really know what their vows are. I've met monks and nuns who had no clue what their vows were. Monks have 253 vows. Even a novice nun has 36 different commitments, vows. And they just never got an explanation or proper training. Those few who maybe saw a list of their vows didn't get commentary from qualified lamas. You know, they didn't know what their vows really were. They got a list of them from some book, but they didn't ever see what the... They never got what is required, which is an oral transmission of the lineage, so where they really understand their vows. Secondly, there's no place for monks and nuns to live in the United States to speak of. I kept my vows primarily because I was living with Ken Rinpoche for 20 years or something in the same house. Every time I got sent on a business trip, it was shaky, you know, and then I got home, you know, like I'd be up with the TV fighting with it all night in these hotel rooms, you know. And you know, you need the support of what we call a Ne Lama. You have to have a monastic mentor who babysits you for 10 years. You're not allowed to do anything but brush your teeth and go to the bathroom without asking them. That's the rule. So we don't have any of these things. We don't have a place for people to stay. We have no financial support. We have no Ne Lamas. We have no correct... We have no commentary, no explanation of what they're doing. They don't even know their vows. And that's what's been happening in the West. And normally they end up staying with lay people or with their families or alone in some apartment someplace, which is not good. It's very difficult to keep your vows then. So what do we do, you know? I think one thing is defining what it is to be a monk or a nun. If I ask you what are the rules for monks and nuns, you know, you'll say three things. They have to be celibate. This is the primary thing in people's minds. They say, oh, they can't have a girlfriend. And then second one, they have to cut their hair. The third one, they have to wear those funny clothes. You know what I mean? And that's about it, you see? And that's, when you say monk or nun, if you think about it honestly, 75% of what you know is those three things. You know what I mean? And is that what Vinaya is? Is that what being a monk or a nun is all about? And I think there's been this crisis where people equate that with what a monk or a nun is, and that's the whole perception of what it means to keep Vinaya or to live in a monastery. And that's not at all what the Vinaya is. You got a taste tonight of what the Vinaya is. And what it is to be a monk or a nun, I mean, when you study the 253 vows of a monk and you try to keep them, I'd say a certain big percent of them, maybe 50%, have to do with not owning. Okay? I mean, if you want to know what it is to be a monk or a nun, in the old days, in ancient India, when you were walking around with Lord Buddha, and he said, if you're going to hang out with us, you got to keep these certain basic rules. Okay? Like, he's walking around India with this group of close disciples, hanging out, studying, you know, eating together, living together, and he said, look, we need basic rules for this. Because so-and-so went to so-and-so's house and broke the dishes, and this other guy sat down on the chair too hard and broke it, and this other guy went to so-and-so's house and he slobbered all over the place, and this guy got caught pee-peeing in the river and ruined the water. These are rules from the Vinaya. You know, I mean, they were... What was happening in ancient India was you had a very attractive or powerful religious teacher teaching a pure path to reach enlightenment. People smelled it. People can smell it. So people started to gather around this person. And then they started to move around together and it became inconvenient. You know, 5's okay, 10's okay, 15 starts to get to be a hassle. 2,500 people are listening to the Diamond Cutter or something. You know what I mean? And, you know, they've got to, at some point, you've got to say, look, you can't spill things on microwave carpet. Okay? No. And we've had the problem at Leon's house. We had this problem. It got to be too large, too many people coming, and then basically harming the sponsor or inconveniencing the people there. And that's where Vinaya was invented. So now Lord Buddha says, okay, up to this time, there's a thing called Lengja in the Vinaya. Lengja means the incident. Every vowel from the Vinaya has a Lengja. Lengja means somebody's... I counted the other night. Michael, close your ears. 9 people spilled stuff on his carpet. Glasses. You know, full glasses. I stepped in one that didn't get cleaned up. Anyway, and then you make a rule. Okay, can't keep glasses on the floor anymore. Just can't do that. That would be a Vinaya rule. You see what I mean? So it's a rule about how do you behave in a group of people trying to devote themselves to study and practice full time, or pretty much full time. Then there's a basic set of rules that you can live together in harmony and function as a group of people moving around. And that's really what the whole point is. Then there was a commitment not to own things. You know, I'm not allowed as a monk to touch money. I'm not allowed to touch a stove. I'm not allowed to prepare food for myself. I'm not allowed to keep food for more than half a day. You know, and the whole principle is that not to own things and not to own other people. And the great beauty of that life and the great freedom you have from not owning anything. I'm only allowed to own 2 sets of robes, period. And a bowl, 1 bowl. And that's a beautiful way to live. I mean, basically, if you really study the Vinaya deeply, and you have 20 people hanging out with you all day, you start to understand why the Vinaya was invented. You know, it's to handle the interaction of people who have committed themselves to this way of life. And the root of that way of life is simplicity. And not owning other people and not owning many things, and the freedom you get from not owning things. You see what I mean? And the basic, and keeping your life down to simplicity. I mean, that's the root of the Vinaya and all the Vinaya rules. I mean, if you study the monks' vows, many of them are either relating to how people who are moving around in a group of 30, 40 people, you know, can live together. You can't hang up the mats when it's raining. That's a Vinaya, you know. You can't do that. And when you're assigned to keep watch on the mats, in case a rainstorm comes, you can't go more than so many feet away from the mats. Now, we don't have mats, we don't have monsoons, but we do have Michael Wick's carpets. You know what I mean? And then you have to... the Vinaya is a living creature. The Vinaya needs to be applied. The last page of the Vinaya Sutra says, in future days, future generations, apply these rules with intelligence and creativity to your modern situation that you have there. You know what I mean? You can't let the Vinaya freeze. You know, you can't go around worrying about the mats and the monsoons, because that's not where we're at right now. But we have an equal problem. What's that? Michael Wick's carpet. You know, is it in the Vinaya? No. Okay, should we watch it? Yes. You know what I mean? And you have to look at the intent. And that's the last pages of the Vinaya Sutra are an admonition from Lord Buddha. Look, don't ever forget in future generations what's the intent of the Vinaya. You know, the Vinaya is a system so that Dharma brothers and sisters can work and live together and study together and practice together and deal with their sponsors together in a harmonious way and in a way that can get them all enlightened quickly and to keep to basic standards so that they have a purity and happiness together that comes from them. And that's the meaning of the Vinaya. So I just think that it hasn't been done that way yet. You know what I mean? The Vinaya has not been practiced this way in Western countries. It's a small group of guys and women trying to kind of half keep some Tibetan cultural thing that they heard about, not knowing their vows, not knowing the principles behind the vows. You see what I mean? Which are more important than the vows themselves. Why is there a vow like that? What was Lord Buddha trying to do? And are we supposed to stick to the vow, or are we supposed to stick to what the intent of this vow is? Is it okay to spill 9 drinks on Michael's carpets in one day? as long as you watch out for the mat during the monsoon season. You see what I mean? And you have to think, what was the function of the vows? What was the purpose that Lord Buddha had in mind when Lord Buddha created the Vinaya? And I think in coming years that will be the test of the Vinaya in the West. And I also think that don't equate Vinaya with simply with ordination. I mean, we're saying three of the eight sets of vows are for lay people. And that whole segment of the vows, I think, you have to pay attention to that. I believe that at least in the next 100 years, this will be the first country in history where the majority of the great lamas are lay people. And that's the way it's going to be. And I believe that Buddhism will be passed on primarily in this country through lay people. And that will be the first time in history that that's really happened. I don't believe there will be an elite of monks and nuns who keep all the knowledge and only they study and only they get to practice and only they get to meditate. And you just go to work and send me a check, okay? It's not going to be like that in America. I like it. I think it's I think the United States is going to be a very interesting case in the history of Buddhism where it'll be passed down. I think, as far as I can see in the near future, there will be great monks and nuns, and there should be, and there should be proper monasteries and nunneries, and they must know what they're doing. And then on top of that, lay people have to consider themselves part of the Vinaya, and they have to take their lifetime layman's vows and keep them. The greatest lamas of our lineage, some of them, you can think of Dzogchenje, you can think of Drapa Gyaltsen of the Vajrayogini lineage, you can think of Art Engel. Okay, it's not the point. The point is that you take some kind of level of layman's vows and you keep them. And then you keep them knowing what they do to you, which is they cause your reality to change if you keep them well. And then I think we have to work really hard on studying the Vinaya and the meaning of the Vinaya, and that just hasn't been done. So I think in this institute, for the monks and nuns who are in this institute, especially out in Arizona, I think we have to work really hard on mastering the Vinaya, and then working really hard to make sure it doesn't die by becoming irrelevant. You see what I mean? We have to study the Vinaya, study the principles. You're going to have out there, if it happens, the 40-year plan is 9,000 people on 9,000 acres. And how are you going to keep harmony? You know, what are the rules? How many drinks can you spill on Michael's carpet before you do something? Okay? And there'll be rules like that. And it will take great intelligence and great compassion and great foresight and great vision to get it right and not just be lazy and say, oh, you know, there wasn't any rule about spilling iced tea? What's that company? Anyway, Arizona iced tea on Michael's carpet. There's no rule like that. We don't have to worry about it. You know, that's obviously not the intent. But I think we're going to have to study Vinaya well, study it deeply, and then apply it to our Sangha, you know, to our situation. And one last example. I mean, this, in the early days, when Lord Buddha was walking around with his 40, 50 people hanging around him all the time, and they decided to wear robes. So how did that happen? He said, I don't want you owning anything. So they said, well, what are we supposed to wear? My old jeans are wearing out, you know. And he said, you can take cloth out of the garbage. You have to pick through other people's garbage and find cloth. And then you can sew it together and make robes. And that was the rule. You could not use a piece of cloth that you did not take out of a piece of somebody's garbage that they had thrown out. So they got patches on their robes because nobody could find a perfect, you know, 12-foot piece of... this thing is big, okay? And so what do they do now? They go to the local village, they buy a 12-foot piece of cloth, and they cut it up into patches, and then they re-sew it together. So it'll have patches on it, you know. Now, I'm not making fun. When I saw Sarah Monastery the first time, I cried. I didn't cry since my mother died. And I just cried, you know. It's the holiest place in the world. And the Tibetans keeping the Vinaya, the Tibetan monks, nuns, it is the happiest life in the world. It's the most incredible thing in the world. You can't imagine. This thing got a little confused, and I think we have to work on stuff like that. That's all. I'm saying, take that holy, beautiful, sacred thing and take it back to the real intent of it. And it'll be something that Westerners will want to do. You know what I mean? And I just hope we can have the wisdom to do that. You know, I think we have to have the wisdom to do that. But it's a beautiful way of life. And we have to study it and find out how to revive it. I think it's one of those things we have to revive. Okay? Vinaya. All right, we'll do a prayer.